continuing our conversation with the communications project, and we're going to talk about disclosures. Give the floor to Catherine.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. So the next session is to talk about the board's targeted standards level review of disclosures. Now, this is a relatively new project that has been added to the agenda, and it's also a very active project at the moment, both in terms of lots of board decisions happening right now and in terms of the staff making plans about how we move this forward over the coming months. So with that in mind, we've got a number of areas where we are really keen to get your advice this morning. Now, what I'm going to do in terms of teeing up, because, like I said, this is a new activity for us, and it is the first time we've discussed it within this group, I'm going to take a couple of minutes just to provide a very high-level overview of the project, and in particular, what the board's objectives are and are not with this project. I will then pause to see if there's any questions or clarifications on the overall direction, and then I will tee up the two areas that we'd like to discuss today. In teeing those up, I will explain how and when the feedback that we receive today will feed into the process that is happening at the moment. So in terms of summary, slides 5 and 6 provide a high-level overview of the project. And really, this has come about as a direct response to the feedback that we received on the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper. Now, I'm sure everyone in the room can well remember the many discussions we've had about the fact that the disclosure problem is multifaceted and will really need the input of many stakeholders if real change is to be made. However, one piece of feedback that we did get from almost everyone that responded to the DP was that one of the factors that contributes to the problem is the disclosure requirements in the standards themselves, and the objective of this project is really for the board to take steps to address and respond to that feedback and improve the way that it does things going forward in terms of developing and drafting disclosure requirements. So in terms of what's actually going on, there are two major strands of activity in the project at the moment, and it is those two strands of activity that form the subject of today's discussion topics. The first is that the board is in the process of developing guidance for itself to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements in future. And really, that is all about the board working out a process by which to develop more effective requirements. At the same time, we are going through a process of selecting one or two standards on which to test that guidance. At the moment, the board is developing guidance only as tentative board decisions, and I stress the word tentative because it will be subject to testing on standards before it is considered in any way final or to be used more broadly. So once the guidance is developed and the standards are selected, we will apply the guidance to the standards that have been picked with the aim of both learning and improving the guidance further and also developing proposed amendments to the standards that are selected. We would then be looking to prepare an exposure draft of those proposed amendments to one or two standards, and in the basis for conclusions to that exposure draft, we would give explanation about how the board had arrived at those proposals, i.e. the guidance for the board. So that exposure draft would enable all stakeholders to give formal feedback on all of the activity that has happened within this project. One clarification that we always like to make when talking about this topic is in terms of the board's objectives. They really are to improve disclosure requirements to make them more effective, i.e. to develop them in a way that will help preparers to provide disclosures that are more useful to users. The board's objective is not to explicitly either increase or decrease the volume of disclosure requirements, albeit that may be a consequence. For example, if in testing the guidance we found that one of the standards we picked contained requirements that were not providing useful information to investors, or indeed there was important and useful information that was not required, it may be that new disclosures would be developed or existing disclosure requirements would be removed, but that in and of itself is not the objective. So before I move on to talk in a bit more detail about the guidance for the board and the questions we have for you there, I am just going to pause in case there are any questions on the overall project before we get into the detail.
Tommaso,
Now, I have a question on the status of this guidance. Will it be an internal document for the board? Will it be public in some form? Will it be perhaps included in the due process handbook or whatever? I mean.
Yeah, that is a good question, and one that we've had quite some debate about. At the moment, what we are doing is developing it in public board meetings and as part of the updates that go out after the board meetings. One of the things I will talk about in one of the upcoming slides is a summary of all of that guidance that we'll be doing in September. At the moment, that is the only place we are planning to record it, because we see the testing that is going to happen in the latter part of this year as absolutely fundamental, and until that's done, any guidance that we develop is very much tentative and draft. So once we have applied that guidance to some standards and seen the practical effects of doing that and likely improved it further, part of the process that we will have after getting feedback on an exposure draft that includes that information will be to decide what to do next in terms of
one way or another. It will be public.
Okay.
At least that's what I expect.
Okay, then I will tee up then the first two questions that we have for you today, which are all about the first strand of activity that I talked about, which is the guidance for the board. So this is summarised on slides 8 to 12. Now, I said at the beginning that this is a very active project at the moment, and that is very much the case. So this topic has been discussed over recent months, will be discussed by the board next week and in September. So slide 8 summarises the process that the board are going through at the moment. Back in May, they discussed what they are thinking of as step one to developing guidance, which is all about how the board will use disclosure objectives going forward. Step two, which was discussed in June, was about process, i.e. what processes can the board go through to ensure that they get the content of disclosure objectives and requirements right. And then step three is all about drafting, i.e. how can we make sure we are drafting disclosure requirements so that the intent that the board had in developing them is reflected as best it can be. Now, we've mentioned a couple of times that everything that's been decided at the moment is very much tentative. And as we have gone through the board meetings over recent months, and I'm sure it will happen again next week, one thing that is happening is in the board meetings themselves, we're having a lot of discussions about potential refinements and ways to further improve what's being developed. In light of all of that, and in light of the feedback that we hear from you today, in September we will be bringing all three steps together to the board in one paper as a summary of everything that's been decided and with potential refinements and considerations that we've learned as we've gone through all of these months of discussion. So it is in September that the feedback that we receive from you today will be formally summarised in a board paper for the board's consideration. In terms of those three steps then, just to summarise the information on slides 9 through 12, slides 9 and 10 summarise the tentative decisions about objectives, which the board decided to discuss first because really we had a huge amount of feedback about objectives in standards today, the fact that some think, you know, they're just not specific enough to be helpful, and the fact that some standards don't contain objectives at all. This is one of the ways that the feedback has suggested we could do things a lot better. So the board has tentatively decided that going forward, all disclosure requirements will be based on a specific objective that relates to exactly what information users want and why they want that information and what they are going to do with it. So we will be looking to spend time with investors, understanding those things and understanding exactly why they want what they want so that we can develop objectives to make that clear to preparers as they are trying to comply with disclosure objectives. Really, the direction we're moving in is one of helping preparers to apply judgment, the theory being that if they understand why a disclosure requirement is suggested, then it will make it more realistic for them to be able to apply judgment about whether that requirement is material in their particular case. So I'll highlight the bottom of slide 9, which shows an example of the kind of thing this might look like. Slide 10 highlights the fact that the board are also planning to continue to use high-level objectives on top of those specific ones, the primary goal of a high-level objective in a standard really being to ask preparers to think when they've complied with all of the specific objectives, is there anything else, anything so entity-specific or different that it hasn't already been captured that I need to also think about disclosing? Step 2 is all about developing disclosure requirements, i.e. the process that the board will use to get the content right. This was subject to a discussion in June, and the things that the board talked about were about how it embeds the development of disclosure requirements throughout the standard setting process and makes sure that it isn't, you know, the last minute item in developing a standard or an amendment, how we leverage the knowledge and experience of our IFRS taxonomy experts to make the best use of that, and the process for fully understanding stakeholder needs to make those objectives that I talked about as helpful as possible. Finally, next week we will be talking about drafting, so we'll be covering things like the use of prescriptive language, making sure language is consistent throughout the standards, so formatting issues such as the use of bold text, where high-level objectives will fit in relative to the specific ones, and ways in which we will leverage information in different standards. So, for example, whether materiality should be referenced everywhere or just linked back to for example, IAS 1. So with that high-level overview, the questions that we have for you are on slide 13. The first question really relates to disclosure objectives, because we see stakeholder engagement as an absolute critical success factor in delivering effective testing later in the year. So question 1 is about whether you have any advice in terms of how we can maximise our stakeholder engagement to make that as effective as possible. And question 2 then is more generally whether you have any suggestions for the board to take in as it works through the process of developing guidance on the development of disclosure objectives and the way that they are drafted. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
Yes, thank you. I have a quick question. Can you elaborate on how the IFRS taxonomy can help you develop disclosure objectives and requirements?
Yes, absolutely. So the taxonomy team have a really deep insight into what I would probably best describe as the disclosure requirements across all of the standards rather than being almost project specific. So the various ways in which we envisage using their input are around things like identifying interactions in disclosure requirements across different standards. They've got a lot of experience in looking at real disclosures, seeing what's done in terms of common practice, things that we can learn from in terms of how our requirements might be done in a way that lends itself to effective delivery of useful information. So it's about the broad experience that they have in looking at disclosure requirements across the board, looking at lots of different financial statements. And the other thing that I will mention there is, I think we've discussed it certainly with this group before, the concept of the impact of electronic reporting on our disclosure requirements. One of the things we are thinking about doing in the immediate term is trying to make all of the requirements that we develop going forward what we are referring to amongst the staff as technology neutral, so making sure we don't develop requirements that could not be applied in an electronic consumption world or equally could not be applied in a more paper-based world. And that's another area where we will be looking to them to provide support. So there's quite a range of things.
And I think there's also another lower level but very, very important part that certainly in my experience they help us with, which is they're used to taking our disclosure requirements and then sort of modelling, for want of a better word, what that looks like from a taxonomy perspective. So they're very good at picking up where we haven't been clear enough of our language. in terms of what the form and what's actually required and what it is we're asking for. They're very good sort of clarity check, mm-hmm. just from a drafting perspective, which I think is also really important.
Andrew?
Thank you. I was actually going to ask the same question as Nobu, but thanks for answering it. So I'll try and answer the questions you've got for us instead. First of all, we're very pleased to see this project on the active agenda and moving forward. Hopefully the first couple of examples will just lead to a broader, more comprehensive review of IFRS disclosures over time, but I recognise that will take some time. I think the process you've outlined makes a lot of sense. I support some comments I think made by ISB board members at the June meeting that the steps should be applied in a flexible and iterative way, not as a sort of not in a mechanical way. That we particularly welcome the reference to cost and benefit. I particularly support also your comments around when you get onto the kind of user engagements, then as well as asking users sort of what they want, ask why they want it and how they use the information to get some deeper insights. I'm not quite sure what you had in mind by understanding the effects of the proposed requirements, but the sort of thing which would be great if it's to the extent it's achievable is to get some willing volunteers among the preparer community to sort of road test, field test what it looks like based on the old existing requirements and the new requirements, a sort of before and after, again, with insights into how they use the proposed objectives and the new style of guidance to actually sharpen their thinking and then to, again, bring that back before and after to the users and, to the extent feasible, again, see if they find that better, worse, indifferent. That, again, might be an iterative process, but I think that practical field testing, asking preparers to actually apply the new requirements will be very important. And a key thing here is how specific can you really be with the disclosure objectives? I think it's perhaps partly an unfair criticism of the objectives we see today that you could sort of substitute the word, take leases and replace it with revenue, and otherwise the disclosure objectives say pretty much the same thing. Now, we don't know where you're going to end up, but if we can get to a more specific objective as to what we're really trying to communicate in each case, I think that would be much more effective.
I do think in some of the newer standards we've tried to be more specific than that. I'm thinking of the leasing standard, looking at CASRA, and also in the new expected credit loss requirements, we have tried to be more specific with the objectives. Yeah. I think the challenge is we don't yet know how that's turned out because it's... We don't have live examples just yet.
Kimberly.
Just in terms of the first question, and when we were discussing this internally, we were reflecting, I guess, on the experiences we had when we were developing the proposals that were in the POD DP around disclosure objectives. And it was quite challenging to develop those specific disclosure objectives, but I think part of our challenge was because we were kind of doing it in isolation, whereas, of course, what you're going to be doing, this is in the context of that stakeholder outreach, which I think is going to be crucial, because one of the things that we often wrestled with, particularly with older standards without a basis for conclusions, was, well, what is the purpose of these disclosures? What are they trying to achieve? So I think when you are doing that stakeholder outreach, the more you can do to draw out from the users why do they want that information, how is it useful, and I particularly liked that, what are they expected to do with it, I think that will also help draw out why it's useful, and perhaps it would be how often would you use it as well might be another question, because in your process you were talking about trying to differentiate between the critical versus the nice to have, and I think that will be helpful as well. Particularly like the idea also that was in your process about talking to preparers, that if they raise cost-benefit concerns, that to ask them, well, what's an alternative? And although that might be in the context of particular disclosure requirements, because I think preparers are more likely to focus on the requirements rather than the objective, in order to come up with that alternative, they're going to have to think about the objective. And that, again, in turn, might help you refine the objective because you're getting more extensive feedback around that objective. And I think another thing to do as part of that outreach, you mentioned the accounting firms, is to, as well as talking to the technical people within the accounting firms who obviously got a lot of practical experience, but also the auditors at the coalface, particularly if you're getting into that point, and I was thinking about some of the early conversation on goodwill, that was an example where you might have an objective and then perhaps some examples of how people might want to meet that objective. From an audit perspective, how do they see that working out in practice, and then which might lead back to the need for quite specific, robust objectives, so therefore it can be more operational for the auditors to be auditing.
Ilham?
That was question number one.
Okay.
Sorry, if we can just do question number two.
Take your time.
On the process, certainly echo Andrew's comments around really helpful process. So obviously it's a lot of what we might do in standard setting generally, but tailored to disclosures. I think the comments that were obviously made at the board meeting about being an iterative process rather than a sequential process. So, for example, step one is something that you're going to have to keep coming back to throughout the course of the project. Step four, when you're talking to preparers, if they do come up with those alternatives, you're going to have to circle back to the users to say, well, what do you think about this alternative? Important for the process to be scalable, because it'll depend on each project as to how much work you do. I think in addition to that, I like the idea of thinking about the objectives through the project and not at the end. What did raise a few concerns was you said you felt that the step at the end might be more of a summary and confirmation process to draw it all together. I think it probably is a bit more important. I think that at the end, that's a good time to actually step back and look at it as a package. Not only as a package within that particular project, but as a package across the suite of disclosure requirements. And that leads into some of the things around slide 12. I think it would be a really good idea to have an inventory of what all the disclosure requirements are across the suite of standards. And you're talking to the taxonomy team about getting at those interactions between where you've got duplication or conflict. And I think that at the end of the process, when you're doing that step back and looking at the package, looking across the suite of standards will be really important. So really encourage you to focus on that summary as well. Thank you.
Linda? Oh, sorry, I was... Ilham, yeah.
Thank you. Regarding question one, so one member of the AOSST suggested an overall outreach program, which is an IFRS-wide program rather than a standard-by-standard approach, is considering the time involved. And one member suggested individual roundtable meetings with investors, preparers, and practitioners and regulators, and conducting preparer focus group study to see how preparers would react to the new test standard drafting. That's all comment about question one. When it comes to question two, AOSS members generally agreed with the board process for developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements. And one member suggested the ISB consider the disclosure requirements across the full set of standards rather than individual standard. And regarding the ISB developing an exposure draft of proposed amendment to the disclosure requirements in the test standards based on the draft guidance, one member suggested other types of documents such as request for information rather than exposure draft, because the test standards could be amended again according to the finalized guidance. Thank you.
Linda?
So, I have a lot of overlap with the comments that Kimberly made, so I won't necessarily repeat, but just kind of add some emphasis. Obviously, it's really important to interact with users because you need to understand their needs, but I think getting the balance right between users and preparers is important. and you're always going to have them go to their separate camps. Users need everything, and preparers don't want to give any more than they absolutely have to, and you need to be the arbiter between those two views. But one question you may want to ask preparers is, well, what do you actually use to manage your business? Because you may find some elements in that approach in terms of meeting specific needs, because the analysts and the users have, or the analysts and the preparers have had those discussions. And you may want to look at those discussions to help you move that along. I also really support the notion of auditability, because you do, there's a tendency for when a new proposal comes out, it's only the head office, the technical people in the firms that look at it, but the audit partners that are in the trenches. And so they have their own perspective, and they can offer some really helpful information. And we found that true when we've been developing our own home standards for private enterprise, that that has made a difference in how we articulate the disclosure requirement to be helpful. So I would do that. And so that would be my generic kind of comments. I think that when you get into your question two, I think don't overlook the obvious, that make sure that you're clear and concise in how you state things, and avoid the, at a minimum, an entity shall disclose kind of stuff. We've already been through that. So avoid that prescriptive language. And I wouldn't lose sight of continuing to emphasize the notion that you'd expect people to use some judgment. Is this matter important or significant or material to the entity? Because if it's not, then they shouldn't be disclosing it. When you get to the point on slide 12 where you talk about duplicative or conflicting requirements, conflicting, obviously you don't want conflicting requirements, but duplicative, the part is that you may want to talk to some more sophisticated preparers, because they've already mapped that out. They've gone through, I know we did, we had to go through and look at all the standards when we transitioned to IFRS, and we said, well, you've got this requirement here and this requirement here and this requirement here. We didn't do note-by-note disclosure. We said, okay, all of these we put in the same note because it's the same information. It's better presentation. The user can get the information all in one spot. It's in context with each other. So that may help you actually identify kind of duplicative requirements. Now, the problem is if you're in a certain situation where it's natural in your industry to look at this standard as opposed to that standard, and you actually think that disclosure is somewhat relevant, maybe with slightly different context between the two, but if the specific entity only really pays attention to the one and you've mapped it out of the other, you can't lose sight of how you deal with that particular disclosure issue. You may need to cross-reference or something like that, but just don't lose sight of that. And if I can think of an example on that, I will.
Jim? The why and the what of the objective, I think we've done a lot of thinking about that as well, and I think we've focused particularly on the why. Why are we asking for this, and why are investors asking for the information? We think that's helpful then to preparers to understand of all the things you're being asked to do, this is why. And I think examples of how and what are useful. Just maybe a caution of, you start to say this is how an investor should use the information. You know, investors use information a lot of different ways. And so maybe a little bit of more focus on the why. The piece on the objective, sort of the question two, we really struggled with. We decided that we should have an objective. It is useful in the context then of requirements. But a lot of discussion of, does the objective supersede the requirements? So if I haven't met the objective, do I have more requirements? I think we sort of left that as, no, the objective is really there to explain the requirements. We're not trying to say this is the minimum list, and to meet the objective you may even have to do more. So we're going to avoid in the future the add a minimum language. I think we're also taking a look where we have it and trying to take that out. Now, we also thought about, in the language you use in paragraph 9, I think we're not going to necessarily go down that path at a standards level that says should consider providing to meet the objective, only in the context of there might be a lot of ways to meet the objective. And so you start to have requirements. For example, we have credit quality disclosures. I might be able to meet those requirements in a different way. We have a tabular format. Investors also like comparability. So if you have entities choosing the way in which they meet those requirements, we've thought you might suffer some comparability loss by entity saying, well, here's one way I might do it. There might be 10 other ways. And so you get the objective, but you lose the ability to do analysis across entities by that choice. And so that's why I think we're probably going to avoid that. But we're also trying to tread the balance of, if this isn't useful in your particular circumstance because it's not material, and I don't know that there's a right answer. I think this is sort of where we are.
Andreas?
Thanks. I'm not going to repeat everything that was said. Just to follow up from Linda's point, parking disclosures potentially in the standard where particular preparers wouldn't be looking into. We've seen that too, and that might be a strong indicator actually of having one disclosure standard rather than having disclosures parked in each and every standard. But I think they could really make use of the IFRS taxonomy team, because they should really inform you as to where duplications actually are taking place. In terms of managing expectations, I'd suggest on slide 12, the second bullet, I would probably advise you to take more cautious wording. So if you say conflicting requirements or multiple similar requirements, one thing that comes to mind is everything that has to do with discounting. Mm-hmm. And you just have had a project on discounting. And if I follow that correctly, I mean, you're not avoiding the duplications or the conflicting requirements. So then probably something is missing. You need to explain then why you do have multiple things that address the same economic phenomenon, but there may be good reasons why you've actually went one way or the other. One bit that I see missing here, but that's probably more for the process thereafter, but I think it should be factored in fairly soon into, that's what's the impact of digital reporting? So the process for drafting disclosures could be entirely different if you have, as an end product, a printed copy of something in mind, or a digital proliferation or dissemination. So knowing that we are trotting more and more towards electronic reporting, I think that should be factored in somewhere. I don't know whether this is too soon, but somewhere in the process and before you actually say an entity shall disclose or shall consider disclosing, I think part of the consideration should also be, is that electronic disclosure or is it general application on paper?
If I may comment on that a little, because I'd be interested in your views on what potentially the board might be discussing in its July meeting. That is one of the topics that is coming. At risk of saying anything before the board have had their public discussion, some of the things that we've talked about are the fact that right at the moment we aren't able to predict exactly what that electronic reporting future will look like. So we've almost got two things going on, which is one, moving this project forward without either, you know, causing problems or developing things that are going to be obsolete in the not too distant future, but then also there's the bigger picture of things that are going to change in the near future. So in the interest of moving this project forward, certainly the discussions that we've had amongst the staff are that we think in the immediate term what will be most helpful is for us, and this is partly what we're working with our taxonomy team on, to be aiming for things that are what we're referring to as technology neutral, so almost not developing requirements that would be unable to be applied in either an electronic or a paper world. But in terms of thinking longer term about what an electronic world will look like, we think that's almost a bigger question that we wouldn't want to hold up progress on this piece of work. So I'd just be interested if you have any thoughts on that line of...
Well, I haven't thought it through entirely, but one thing that I think might be a consequence of going electronic is that there is a higher likelihood that disclosures might be divorced from, say, the numbers. So if you have something on printed paper, you could probably always say in one report you've got everything. But once you go digital, it may very well be that the numbers, the pure numbers in the financial statements, are taken separately from the note disclosures, and they're not that much linked as they were if the end product was a written report. But there may be other issues. This is probably more a general flag here. Be reminded that the environment is changing, and don't be too obsessed in thinking, okay, I want to be comprehensive in all sorts of things, because the comprehensiveness might be the first thing that flies out of the window once we go electronic.
Okay. We can move on.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so the second part of the discussion that we wanted to have is around which standard or standards the board might select for review. So our work here today is summarised from slide 15 onwards. So what I will do here is briefly talk about the work that the staff has done and the position we are in relative to upcoming board decisions. So what we have done to date is based on all of the feedback we've had throughout the principles of disclosure discussion paper, the large amounts of outreach that we did during last year, and feedback we've had from consultation with several of our consultative groups over the last few months, we have identified 9 standards that we have consistently heard are examples of the problems that stakeholders see within the IFRS standard disclosure requirements that might be good candidates for review. And it is that shortlist of 9 standards that the board decision is largely going to be based on. Just to highlight one important point on slide 15, we will not be looking to test any standard that is relatively new. By that, I mean a standard that essentially has not had a post-implementation review yet. So that includes, of course, 15, 16, 17. We're including IFRS 7 within that category because of its close linkages with 9. So we often get a question along the lines of, you know, could we not consider one of those standards? But we think at this point it will perhaps be more disruptive than helpful to relook at disclosure requirements of those. So you will see that they are not on the list. So the standards that have been identified and shortlisted are listed on slide 17. And really the reason that they are there is because they have one, some or all of the typical disclosure problems that stakeholders have identified. So problems around disclosure objectives, things like duplications, costly disclosures that are difficult to understand, and these are also standards where investors tell us the information that they get from financial statements is not perhaps as useful as they would like it to be. So based on that shortlist on slide 17, we have had consultations with some of our other groups, so CMAC and GPF, and we actually did those consultations together last month and got both groups in the same room. In light of all of that and the research we've done, we have prepared a board paper for July that will ask the board to make this decision. So what we are going to do with the feedback that we receive from you today is actually provide the board with a verbal summary in next week's meeting so they can factor the feedback that we receive from you into the decision. So just before I hand over to ask your views on which standard you would support the board selecting, I'd just like to highlight 2 really important things which are on slide 18. And essentially what those 2 things highlight are the objectives we have for the standard or standards that we pick. Firstly, and most importantly, we want the standards that we pick to be good candidates for testing the guidance for the board. And in order for that to be the case, we would like them to contain as many as possible of the typical disclosure problems that stakeholders have identified. Secondly, we would like to pick standards that would benefit individually from a review of their disclosure requirements, because one of the outcomes of this process may well be that we will make some amendments to those standards. Now, in an ideal world, we believe we should be able to pick standards that will satisfy both of those objectives, and it is those 2 things we will have in mind when asking the board to make the decision. So with that, I am going to hand over for your thoughts. Like I said, the board paper has been posted, but we are planning to give your feedback in that meeting, and we'd like you to give your feedback on the complete shortlist rather than being sort of biased by the staff recommendation that has been made in the paper. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
Okay, Linda?
So we decided to actually do a quick survey. So we surveyed our board members, we surveyed our IFRS discussion group, and we surveyed our user advisory council. And by quite a margin, the number one pick was share-based payments. For all of the reasons that you have in number two there, in their view, okay? The second was business combinations. And some notable mention of the topics we just discussed. This sort of was good. And then there was a tie for number three in terms of the number of votes. Fair value measurement, employee benefits, and statements of cash flows. So what we didn't get in our survey was kind of the next level of, you know, why. So if you're interested, we could, you know, you can capture that information. You can come back to us and tell us you want us to go to the next layer. We'll go back to them and ask for some more granular information, but we thought that was a little bit more objective way to ask for the information rather than just formulate it ourselves.
Coincidentally, we got share-based payment, fair value measurement, and statement of cash flows as the ones that that can contribute more for the debate. But I focus my comment on share-based payment here. I think the question here is a little bit complex because, of course, management remuneration is an important thing. So we have a lot of disclosures about management remuneration. But the way the information is portrayed at the moment is pretty much descriptive. So managers got that. These are the stock options, for example. These are restricted shares. This amount is vested. But there's no connection with the actual relevant question. Is this compensation as a whole making sense? So it's compensation as a whole linked to value creation. And then what most people said was, well, at least partially, this is very important information, but it should be on the footnotes, or it's something that should be somewhere else. So, and the way the information is portrayed at the moment, it doesn't feel the main criteria, which is that's not the information that, well, at least that's not the all the information that the users need, especially from a corporate governance perspective, to understand how the management compensation is designed. But then the second question is, should that information be on that score, or should that be on management commentary, or should be somewhere else? Because you see some companies, they actually disclose, the top executives, they disclose their contracts, their targets specifically. They say, well, this guy has fulfilled 75% of their targets, and then the compensation is da-da-da-da-da. So that information is very important. Well, what is the CFO contract? What is the CEO contract? Should the information be on the footnotes, or it's a bit, honestly, I don't know exactly the answer, but the way that is at the moment, the IFRS 2, the information is of very, very little or no use at all.
Kimberly?
So we did some outreach in both New Zealand and Australia, so I'll sort of cover both as we go through. Of the lists that you've got there on slide 17, there was a general consensus. IFRS 13 came out as sort of the top pick, and I think in the board paper you'd actually matched up against your criteria, and it wasn't surprising you had ticked some lots of the boxes. So I think everybody agreed with that analysis, and particularly it would benefit from having clearer disclosure objectives. That was the key point that people found it's quite hard to comply with. Then certainly in the New Zealand discussion, we went a bit off-piste, and people could not resist talking about IFRS 7, recognising that it wasn't on the list, for the reasons that you've outlined. But it's particularly reflecting a view coming from people working with corporates as opposed to financial institutions. People talked about the fact that the standard was developed, had a history as being a standard for financial institutions, but then was applied more broadly, recognising, yes, that it's going to change with IFRS 9 coming in, but it's one that is a continual bugbear whenever we talk to people about disclosures, it keeps coming up. And I think it is a lot of that is around not understanding the objectives of the disclosures. So you get a lot of boilerplate jargon type disclosures that people don't understand because people don't really understand what they're trying to achieve. So, well, understanding why it's not on your list, I think there was a plea that if it could be on a subsequent list at the top, they would be very happy with that. Returning then to what we were supposed to be talking about, which is the list, it was felt that it would be a good idea to pick one, an older standard, to give you a contrast between some of the newer standards and older standards. And IS 16 is one that came out in both New Zealand and Australia, is one that could be looked at. It was, you know, it was felt it's an old standard. There's a lot of stuff gets disclosed. How useful is it? Doesn't have objectives, so that might be a good one to use. Looking at the rest of the ones on the list, we've got sort of mixed views. Interesting enough, you know, having heard a lot about IFRS 2, we got some that said, oh, I wouldn't bother looking at IFRS 2, but then we also got a contrasting view that said, actually, yes, it would be a good idea to look at IFRS 2, that it's a complex standard, and it would benefit from an overhaul. And it was suggested that doing that in conjunction with IS 19, because then you'd be covering the suite of employee benefits. We didn't get a lot of votes for IFRS 8. It was felt too specific. IS 12 in particular, people rejected as being a good one to look at. They felt that really there was some more fundamental issues, that it was a complex standard. And that's why the disclosures are complex, and that really, to deal with that, you probably have to do something a bit broader than just look at the standard. So I think, yeah, the overall theme, I think, would be IFRS's 13 and 16 and some support for doing IFRS's 2 and IS 19.
Cedric?
Thank you, Hans. We have not... feedback of our constituents specifically on that, but based on what has been discussed to date in the Disclosure Initiative project, I would say there are, as you describe on page 16, two main situations. Situation where people think that they have to provide a lot of information without understanding well the objective in the financial statement, probably the case for IS 19, IFRS 2, and probably IFRS 7 for corporate, because they can probably understand that it's information that may be interesting for when it is related to sensitive or key person in the company. But on the other hand, is it actually a financial information, or should it be reported elsewhere in the financial report of the corporate reporting? That's a question that is often raised. In that regard, it makes sense to analyze one of the three in order to find what is actually required from a pure financial point of view, and what may be what are actually the objective in this regard. And on the other hand, there is probably IFRS 3, IFRS 8, where there is a lot of expectation, maybe also IS 37, where people feel that sometimes the information is very scarce and may require further additional information, and that's another view in your exercise. How far you would recommend or ask for additional requirements for such standards?
Andrew,
thank you. We consulted our technical expert group and our European standard setters gathering on this, didn't get as far as running a survey. I think when you're presented with a question like this, the answer depends on the lens you look through. And I think for a number of people would look through the lens of, in their view, which is the most problematic standard, or to be more positive, which standard has the greatest potential for improvement when we're through the whole iterative process and we apply the new thinking. I'm not quite, in terms of the process you're about to embark on, I'm not quite sure that's the right lens. I think it's more which are the most suitable guinea pigs.
Yeah.
And we're going to actually go to preparers and ask them to sort of workshop how the new disclosures might look like and then take that back to users. I think I'm able to stay away from the highest impact standards, use this process to try and sharpen the process, sharpen the thinking, and then apply that to the higher impact standards later on down the track. All that said, I think we have strong agreement with Kimberley's proposal that it made sense to include, it's only going to be two, one older standard, one IIS that doesn't have any kind of disclosure objective right now, or not an explicit one, one of the newer standards. In contrast to Kimberley, I think among the older standards, then IIS 12 and IIS 19 came up most frequently. IIS 12, one of our constituents said that the reason to include this one is that the requirements actually seem to focus more on accounting technicalities, sources of temporary differences, that kind of thing, than information that's obviously going to be useful in meeting the objectives of financial reporting. So that was the rationale there. And I think we, among the newer standards, then probably IFRS 13 and again IFRS 2 came up most frequently.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. I have a question and a few comments. We had the impression that the ASB had already decided to pick up IFRS 13 as part of the PIR. And if that is not the case, and if it's not chosen under this initiative, what would happen with the PIR on IFRS 13?
So the decision that was made in the IFRS 13 PIR was that it would come to the disclosure initiative to consider whether it would be a good candidate for this process. If the board do decide to select IFRS 13, then one of the inputs into the process that we would undertake in the coming months would be all of the feedback that we already have from the PIR. If the board decide not to pick IFRS 13, then there would be another decision to be made by the board, which would be in light of that. Do we then still close the IFRS 13 PIR, or is there a separate exercise to be undertaken under the PIR umbrella rather than the targeted standards level review umbrella? So should the board not pick it, there will be an active decision about what it will do in light of not picking it.
I guess our view is that maybe one or two would be too few. You might want to pick more than two standards to address. And if you do that, you might be able to incorporate IFRS 13 into your set of standards. In terms of the standards that we believe should be undertaken, the popular ones were IFRS 2, IS 19, and IFRS 7. And on IFRS 7, we understand that it does relate to IFRS 9 with the new requirements, but at the same time, some have mentioned that there are some requirements in IFRS 7 that existed before IFRS 9, and some of those could be problematic to some of our constituents, and therefore they believe that IFRS 7 should not be removed from the list.
Thank you. We also did a survey among our advisory council members, and business combination comes as the first choice. The reasons are, for one, the board is having the impairment and goodwill and impairment project at the moment, so it can be a good chance to test the guidance. And secondly, disclosure varies dramatically in the practice nowadays in this area. And thirdly, disclosure in this standard covers both recognition and measurement, and also disclosure of information.
Alberto?
We have not engaged our stakeholders on this, so I can only offer my personal view. I would select IFRS 3, and the reason is that based on previous discussion, there is a gap between what the preparers are prepared to give as information, as little as possible, no details, just main thing, and what the investor would like to have, a lot of more details, especially forward-looking details, as we have discussed before. So if you said you want to engage both preparers and investors, might be a good idea to test these different views and to ask what is really important for the users on this topic, especially for forward-looking information.
Andreas? One topic that didn't come up that I would advise you strongly to keep an eye on is IAS 34 on interim reporting. Because whilst I agree with all the comments that have been made in terms of annual financial statements, and I wouldn't repeat them, I think there seems to be a missing link into what do you do in interims. And the standard is quite old, hasn't been amended that often, and I think it is an urgent need really to be overhauled. And then the question is, okay, how would an interim standard fit the general objectives and the approach that you are currently envisaging for drafting disclosures? So I would keep that in mind as well.
Ilhan?
Thank you. So most AOSS members suggest selecting two types of standards based on old and new standards, and standard with and without disclosure objective, and standard used widely and narrowly. All members commented preferred IFRS 13 because it has all four category disclosure issues, and some members suggested IFRS 3 and IS 12. Thank
you. Okay, I'm going to ask what is actually really interesting about this is that we will be giving this feedback to the board a week from now, next Wednesday morning. And what I had wondered coming into this meeting is whether I would be able to go to the board next week and say, ASF members support this standard. I think I can say with confidence that that is not going to be the feedback that we will deliver. We've heard a lot of different views, which we will definitely reflect. I'm trying to identify which standards really have come out on top, and it is quite difficult. We've had several mentions of quite a number of them. So I think there's quite a bit of support for IFRS 2, quite a bit of support for IFRS 3, IAS 19, IFRS 13, and then we've also had a couple of mentions of IAS 7, IAS 12, one mention of 16, and several for IFRS 7. So I'm
just doing them all.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if I should raise a review for
you the... achieve the result. No one has mentioned IAS 21. You can take it out.
That may be how I sum it up. Thank you. So the best I can do in terms of summation is to assure you that we will provide the feedback, although I suspect we will be listening back to this meeting amongst our team and working out how best to do that. What I am going to do, in case it's useful, is let you know some of the feedback we've had from other sources since we wrote the slides for this session, which was a good month or so ago now, because you know it may be of interest. So we met with our CMAC and GPF groups last month, and like I said, we had sort of joint breakout groups, so we got both users and preparers around the table to talk about those. And I would say that the outcome was not dissimilar to today in terms of there being different standards that were supported. But coming out of that process, we felt that we are left really with four candidates that the staff feel are likely to be the realistic ones, those four being IAS 19, IFRS 2, IFRS 3, and IFRS 13. And that is for many of the same standards that have been raised today and for many of the same reasons. Just a couple of interesting things that came up in those discussions that in case you know anyone has got views on them, is that one of the things we've been very much thinking about is understanding the reasons why standards are or aren't supported, because there are some examples where the reason standards might be supported is more to do with recognition and measurement than being isolated to disclosure. And what we don't want to do is risk sort of scope creep with the standard we pick. So off the back of all the feedback we've had, that might be a reason to not lean towards a standard that has had support, but that still does leave us with a few. So I think it's going to be a very, very interesting board meeting next week, but thank you very much for your feedback. I'm also going to briefly sum up what we heard on the board's process. This will be subject to discussion in September and be in a board paper, so we've got slightly longer to summarise that one more formally, but just in terms of the key things we heard, in case anyone wants to tell me that we've missed anything. In terms of the advice we asked for on outreach and making that as effective as possible, we've got loads of great suggestions there. So to do with field testing with preparers, talking to preparers about cost benefit, and when they do have cost concerns, asking them what alternatives they would suggest, thinking about round tables with multiple stakeholders, understanding how preparers use information to manage their business, because that in itself might help us to identify objectives, try and leverage work that's some preparers have already done in terms of mapping out duplications, and then a lot of support for focusing our user outreach on why information is wanted, what are users going to do with it, and also how often they're going to use it in terms of prioritisation. And then in terms of the board's process, we heard quite a bit of support for maintaining the flexible, iterative nature of the process and making sure we do have it in a way that is scalable to a project, highlighted the importance of looking at disclosures as a package at the end of the project, albeit support for also considering it throughout, and highlighting again the importance of specific objectives and the importance of stakeholder outreach. So quite a number of things there which we will feed back into the board in September. But thank you very much for your input.
Going to make one observation, sort of slightly different to your summing up, but one discussion that we got quite bogged down in, or we had an extensive discussion about at the last board meeting, was what the objective of the testing was. And I think it related a little bit to the point that Andrew made, which is I think a lot of people, when we ask them what standard do they think we should start with, are choosing the standard they think is the most broken in terms of the quality of disclosure they see, or how frustrated they are when they use it. But the question probably, and I look forward to reading the board paper, will be what is it we're trying to test? So it may not be that we need to start with the most broken standard, if what you want to test is how we work with users and work out how to best capture objectives. Maybe there's a standard that works better for that purpose. And also, I actually thought Andrew's observation that maybe starting with not the most broken thing first while we work out if our process works might be a sensible thing to do, which I hadn't thought about so directly before. So I just encourage you, Catherine, to reflect on those couple of points.
Francois?
Yeah, one question that the various proposals that have been made arise to me is we had completed the discussion around the disclosures, possible disclosures on business combinations and impairment. And it seemed out of this discussion that there was support for improving the disclosures, and there was also the warning by Andrew saying, be cautious in what you do, that you have in mind how disclosures out of the disclosure initiative should be provided written. So I understand that IFRS 3 has been mentioned by many of you, but for those of you who have not identified IFRS 3 as a possible candidate, what is your recommendation? That we do nothing for the time being on IFRS 3, or that we continue to issue possible disclosure requirements in the old style?
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this discussion.
It was a question. Thank you for noticing it.
Are there answers?
Well, I think I was one of the people that didn't mention IFRS 3. It did come up just as possible, but I guess when I gave my summation, I focused on the most common themes. And I guess the reason why is that people were focusing on the objectives of what which is on the slide from the slide now that sort of sets the slide 18, which says what the staff were trying to achieve with selecting the standards. People were thinking about what's going to be the best test for the standard, and so the second one, what would benefit individually from a review of disclosure requirements. I think IRFRS 13 sort of ticked a lot of the boxes for that, and then the relevant testing, that was when we got to the idea of picking an older standard to sort of weigh up against it. So I don't think people were necessarily saying IFRS 3 wasn't a good candidate. It was just that in the context of all the possibilities, I think if we went back and said, how about we look at IFRS 3, everybody would say, yes, that would be a good idea. I don't know if that helps answer your question. But
well, it seems to me most practical to not have multiple reviews of the same standard under different projects. So if IFRS 3 is going to be a candidate for the Stiles level review, then suspend work coming out of the goodwill and impairment projects, and the converse would also apply. So
all right, then.